Thank you, fellas, for the songs in which you've led us, and appreciate our brothers who've led us in our prayers this morning. I wonder how will my way of thinking or my way of looking at things be any different when we leave this morning than it was when I got here. Do you think that our exercise together of serving the Lord should make a change in how we look at life in this new week? I know ahead of time that when I leave, I'll be pretty much the same person I was when I got here. I'll be a couple hours older, but the same fellow. And I'll head out to meet a world that's mostly the same as it was when I arrived this morning. But I'm here. I came partly because I expect that this experience will in some way retune my thought process for this new week so that I can live positively and live as well as I can and hopefully make good use of God's gift of a new start today. Psalm 40 is about how that reorganization of outlook happens. It is a psalm which lets us think about how we sort of recalibrate. How it faces the fact that things happen in life which, even though we started new, place challenges in the way of our hoping, and it invites us to hope again and to reorient our thinking in that way. There are a lot of important things about Psalm 40. Among them is the fact that the New Testament applies it specifically to Jesus and why he came. But this psalm is especially valuable for this reason. To me, Psalm 40 presents the most realistic view of hoping that there is. Hope is not a sort of a Pollyannish thing where Christians present simpleton answers to a world of hurt and difficulty. Hoping is something which is a discipline which we have to re-engage in periodically in our lives in order to keep our hoping, the tone of our lives. This morning, I'd like to take a few moments just to trace this process that I hope happens even while we're together this morning through Psalm 40. Look at it with me. Here's how it starts. I remember how good the Lord has already been to me in delivering me and in rescuing me and bringing me up from the pit. In some way or another, in Psalm 40, the writer has been lifted up or delivered in this way. It's left open-ended. He doesn't specify the event so that we're invited into the process. I waited patiently for the Lord, and he reached down to me and heard my cry. He brought me up out of the pit of destruction, out of the mud, and he set my feet on a rock, making my footsteps firm. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and will trust in the Lord. You can like a little child, hear him waiting patiently for the Lord and the Lord reaching down, and then notice what happens. The Lord, responsive to his cry, he brings him up, sets his feet on a good solid footing, puts a new song in his mouth. And the writer says, a lot of other people will see this and will respect the Lord and will be moved to trust in him also. When have been, sitting here right now, can you remember any of those times in your life? If you say generically, the Lord has already brought me up before, can you think of any of those times specifically? When was it in your life that you waited patiently and the Lord reached down and brought you up out of the pit out of the mud and set you on solid ground and put a new song in your mouth. When was that? One way in which it's true for all of us is what we've just remembered together as Aaron led us in thinking about God's goodness and mercy and love, even in offering up his son for us. Remember that if we're Christians, that means that God, at some point, got involved with us in the person of his son in our world, that he raised us up, that he cleansed us, that he made a new covenant with us, and he allows us to live in his family. We have a new song in that way. Any of the hoping in the middle of any of the hard places of life doesn't start with a zeroing in on the hard place and inspecting it. It starts with remembering how good God has already been to us in our lives. Secondly, I affirm the song of trust to which I want my life attuned. Now, I'm not saying I can sing it in tune, but I am saying I can choose the song that I want my life to be tuned to. Used to in our Bible camps in the summertime, which we got to work with for many years, there'd be a night when we'd just have somebody to come and entertain us after our worship time. Carrie would come down there. He's kind enough to make that trip several times and do a show for us, just sing for us. He'd get there in the afternoon, set up his equipment, and then I'd see him out there tuning his guitar or his keyboard or whatever it was. And I've thought at times, he didn't do that because he on purpose got them out of tune. He just did it because he wanted them to be in tune. And our lives are a little bit like that. So how does that happen? Here's what he says, verses 4 and 5. And some writers think, by the way, that this is the new song that God gave him. These two verses are the new song. How blessed is the man who has made the Lord his trust and has not turned to the proud, nor to those who become involved in falsehood. Many, Lord my God, are the wonders which you have done, and your thoughts toward us. There is no one to compare with you. I would declare and speak of them, they would be too numerous to count. That's a pretty good song. All of our lives are tuned to whatever we think really makes people happy in the end. What do you think it is? This song says, the one who's really blessed is the man who's made the Lord his trust. In the words of Jeremiah 17 and verse 7, he's the one who's like a tree planted by the water. And he's the one who really discovers rewarding contentment in his life. This man is blessed because he hasn't turned to the arrogance of man nor the idolatry that people practice. He instead plugs his life into the long stream of wonders that God has worked in delivering his people and in thinking of his people. The Lord has been mindful of us. This is the song. And if I would try to even describe what all God has done, there'd be too many things even to count. That's what the writer says. There's a lot of songs that appeal to us to tune our lives to them. A lot of them are tragedies. A lot of them are bad things. A lot of them are injustices. A lot of them are unfair things. A lot of them are things to worry over. How much better would it be to tune my life to this one? You know, I live a week and my life gets out of tune. I get scared about things, worried about things, torn up about things, sorry about things, and I need my life to be brought back to this song here. Don't you? Surely I'm not the only one. That's what we're here to do, trying to do today, and so to help, for God to help us do. And then third, I offer myself to God with an ear for His will and a heart for His will. This is the part of this passage that the New Testament puts in the mouth of Jesus and uses it to explain why He came and what He has done for us. You have not desired sacrifice and offering. You have opened my ears. You have not required burnt offering and sin offering. Then I said, behold, I have come. It is written of me in the scroll of the book. I delight to do your will, my God. Your law is within my heart. Ordinarily, when someone would be delivered from the pit of some sort, and when he would be moved with trust in God and thankful to Him, that person would be expected to bring an animal or some other kind of offering to the temple for it to be offered on the altar to God. The law gave those privileges to God's people as a way to cover our sins and as a way to express our gratitude to Him. But in this case, the writer says, I'm not coming with an offering like that. I'm looking into what the book of your law called for from me, and I'm offering myself to you in keeping with that. It got to be hard in the Old Testament, it seems like, for people to bear in mind what the purpose of God's of the offerings and sacrifices were. They started thinking that somehow God needed them. Psalm 50 shows this. What God really wanted was for people to keep their word and to be thankful to Him. Old Saul in 1 Samuel 15 and verse 22, when he had been sent to exercise God's judgment on the Amalekites and destroy everything they had as a devoted sacrifice to God, kept all of that was worth anything alive. Samuel went to meet him, and Saul said, I've done it. And Samuel said, What's this sound in my ears? It sounds like flocks and herds then. Saul said, the people did that. And Samuel told him, listen, to obey is better than sacrifice. To pay attention to God's will is better than sacrifices and offerings. In Micah's day, in Micah chapter 6, his countrymen got to acting like God expected too much from them. If we could give rivers of oil and thousands of sacrifices, would He be pleased with that? And Micah said, you know what the Lord requires of you. Do justly, love kindness, and walk humbly with your God. Well, it's always been hard for us to keep the main things the main things. We fall short at that. And our actions don't correspond to the kind of trust that's been expressed in verse 4. So the Hebrew writer says, along comes Jesus. Hebrews 10, verses 5 and following, quotes this. It says, it's written of Jesus. He came, Jesus Christ came with an ear for God's law, with a heart that delighted to do what God says, and that He actually gave Himself in such a way that He would be one sacrifice for sins forever, and so that all the work of offering would be done in Him. All of us who follow Him need something of this same spirit in our lives. This should be our response to Jesus. Not just songs and prayers and Lord's Suppers and offerings, but to present ourselves. Not just to sit and listen to the preacher, but to give ourselves in some way, to open our hearts to God's will, to delight in doing His will within our hearts. I noticed one comment that Walter Brueggemann made about this passage here I think is relevant. He says, "So what does one with the new song do? He engages in new obedience, an embrace of the will of God, which is not a burden, but a delight." In our subjective culture, with repression, or with its preoccupation with repression and the need to be me, we imagine that the new life is one of utter freedom without expectation from us. But not here. The new life is one in which obedience to God is an utter delight. That's a good comment. So follow the process now. I remember how good the Lord's already been to me. I affirm the song of trust that I want my life tuned to. I offer myself to God with an ear for His will and heart to do it. And then I am present in the lives of other people with good news of righteousness. And this can't just be one person and one person. It's not just that one person gets up and talks about God's will. It's good news of righteousness that's the focus of it. You've heard enough bad news probably in the last few days. Verse 9 and 10. "I have proclaimed good news of righteousness in the great congregation." I like that. "Behold, I will not restrain my lips, Lord. You know I've not hidden your righteousness within my heart. I've spoken of your faithfulness and in your salvation. I've not concealed your mercy and your truth from the great congregation." What does that have to do with all of us? Well, notice the language of this verse. In every way he can, he says, I've gone public with what you mean in my life and what you've done for me. I've proclaimed in the great congregation. I will not restrain. I have not hidden. I have spoken. I've not concealed. And then notice what he has publicized. It's good news of righteousness, your faithfulness, your salvation, your mercy, your truth. All of those are characteristics of God. They're all who He is. You young people I got to study with a couple years ago, maybe we'll remember Exodus 34 in verses 6 and 7. That's where all those phrases came from. What he's saying is, you lifted me up and I went among people and I tried to give them the good news of who you are and what you do in people's lives. One comment I found in my favorite one volume says, "God's work of deliverance has not been kept for His own secret delight. The faithfulness, mercy, and truth of the Lord have been preached before crowds. His salvation has been advertised." And then this observation is offered. "The reality of a man's testimony about the state of his heart is seen in his willingness to share the good news of God with others. If private religion does not become public, it ceases to be true." You have something that other people need. Good news of righteousness, good news of a God who is salvation, who is faithful and merciful and true, that could be passed along into other people's lives. And that, if we think of it not simply as our duty of evangelism, but as a part of renewing, hoping, then we do better that way. And then the next step, with all of this running in the background, now's the crucial moment. I renew confidence in the Lord's continuing mercy in my present plight. And that's what I mentioned a while ago. I came here this morning, but I got to go back to deal with how things really are in the world where I live. So notice in verse 11. Verse 11 is translated here like a statement and not like a question. I think it's better this way in this case. You, Lord, will not withhold your compassion from me. Your mercy and your truth will continually watch over me. For evils beyond number have surrounded me. My guilty deeds have overtaken me so that I am not able to see. They are more numerous than the hairs of my head, and my heart has failed me. Is that the way you expected Hope to talk? After all of the positive things that have been said in the first part of this passage until now, is this what you expected? Here he is in verse 12, surrounded by evils, overtaken by guilty deeds of his own. And instead of thinking of how God's wonders are too numerous to count, now he thinks, these problems are more numerous than the hairs of my head. Instead of a heart that delights to do his will, now his heart has failed him. But notice the discipline of hoping. Verse 11. You will not withhold compassion, mercy, and truth from me, because that's who you are. That's who I have known you to be. That's who you will continue to be in this situation in my life. I love a comment I ran across from James L. Mays. Verse 11 is the psalmist trusting himself to the gospel he has proclaimed in the situation in which he now is. And notice, he does what is usually so difficult to do. Live by the gospel you preach. To live by the gospel you obeyed. To live by the gospel you believe. That's the hard thing to do. And then the other step. Finally, I cast my cares before him. Call on him to be my help. And then go out and face life anew. That's what happens, verse 13 through 17. Be pleased, Lord, to rescue me. Hurry, Lord, to help me. Does that sound like somebody who's waiting patiently to you? Hurry, Lord, to help me. May those be ashamed and humiliated together who seek my life to destroy it. May those be turned back and dishonored who delight in my hurt. May those be appalled because of their shame who say to me, aha, aha. I'm told that those two words are a bad combination of mockery at your problems and delight that you're having them. May all who seek you rejoice and be glad in you. May those who love your salvation continually say, the Lord be exalted. But I am afflicted and needy. May the Lord be mindful of me. You are my help and my Savior. Do not delay, my God. The way this psalm begins, I waited patiently for the Lord, and the way it ends, do not delay, my God, is what I mean about our view of hoping. There is a spiritual discipline in this process that takes place when we, on purpose, gather together to refocus, reorient, reorganize, and retune how we see life. This psalm ends with facing squarely the problems that are present and asking the Lord to deal with them, and then asking Him to place joy where it rightfully belongs, in the lives of people who love Him and trust Him and walk with Him. And then it has an appeal. Please help me to be one of them this week. I said we may not have expected the cry for help to come here as vividly as it does after the song of trust and the delight to do His will and the proclaiming of the good news and the hoping that's implicit in all of those things. But that's the reality of this psalm. And that's the reality of the faith that we hold. Yes, you're raised up when you obey the gospel to walk in newness of life, but it's still life. And life is lived by human people who are not home yet. So sometimes the growth that we're looking for happens, but not in a single straight line that's always upward. Sometimes it's a wavelength that way. But this is a realism that's set within a well-grounded trust in a true fact. There is one who came and did God's will, who offered Himself as one sacrifice for sin forever, and who is able to save to the uttermost anyone who will come to God through Him. That's us. That's all we're saying about ourselves. We're trying to come to God through the one who is able to save. You're invited to be a part of the story. You're invited to believe that what Christ has done is sufficient, to confess that you believe He's sitting at God's right hand, having made purification for sin and now ruling over His kingdom as the high priest of His people. You're invited to let your life be joined to His in repentance and baptism and in new life. If we can help you in that way, please let us know of your desire by coming while we stand and sing together.